The following program is an MLWRadio.com production.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Eastern Lariat Podcast, your show for news notes, reviews, and opinions on the world of Japanese pro wrestling here on the MLW Radio Network. I want to wish you a happy new year, and of course, the year in Japanese pro wrestling always, well, it doesn't really begin with Wrestle Kingdom, but it's the first real major event of every year in Japanese professional wrestling. So me, your hosts Trigger and Dylan, we gathered our thoughts for a couple of minutes after the show ended. And here we are right after the second night of Wrestle Kingdom 15 to talk about both events.
That's absolutely right, Striga. And I know what we're all here for, the big controversy on both of these shows. And I think we need to get to it right away. And it's, you know, even my grandma called me on this, Mamaw called me on this myself, and I couldn't believe it when she told me, but she claimed that, now, I know you're not going to believe this, Striga, but a wrestling company false advertised as Carlito was not on the Raw Legends episode tonight, and I was shocked by this. It put me in a bad mood when I watched the New Japan shows, but I just wanted to get that off the top of the dome here because I was just stunned that a wrestling company would lie to its fans and false advertise someone.
That's never been done before. I'm in shock as you are. I mean, how can WWE do something like this?
And Carlito, of all people.
Carlito!
One of the biggest legends of WWE, for sure. Now, to be fair, New Japan has probably brought out, like, remember when they did the Rambos of the past? I know we're going to talk about the one here, but they've brought out some pretty auspicious legends before. But I think Carlito is kind of a stretch, with all due respect, to a legend.
Did he ever have, like, a five-year run or so? I'm not sure.
Yeah, he was around for a few years. Is that all it takes to be a legend now? Yeah.
Damn, I guess it does.
Yeah, okay. I'm half a step from being a legend than in WWE's eyes. There.
Maybe Dylan, at some point you'll get to challenge Kota Ibushi for the double IWGP Heavyweight Championship in, I don't know, name some place in Tennessee that has 50 people.
Oh God, I don't know. Like, I'm sure there are many places like that on the east side. Like I said, Tennessee has so many misconceptions, man, when it comes to the western side of it. But the eastern side is definitely much more like that. But I'm sure there's somewhere. What was that place that James Storm is from? like in Tennessee. Wherever he's from is where we'll have our match, for sure. I would say Leaper's Fork or something like that.
Let's see. Let's find out. Franklin, Tennessee.
Oh, no, that's a pretty big city.
Okay.
Paramore is from Franklin, Tennessee. That's not that far from me. Pop punk band of the 2000s. I think they're still around. I'm not really sure. Hmm. But I'm sticking with Leaper's Fork. That just sounds like a very small place. Okay. So here it is. Leaper's Fork, an unincorporated rural village in Williamson County, has a population of about 650. So 600 more than 50, but that's probably about the smallest place I can think of in Tennessee.
I will name one place that I think has about 50 people. I will name that place. It's a very small, tiny village in Germany.
Okay.
It's called Faule Butter, which translates, yes, it's rotten butter.
Whoa.
That's the name of the village.
Okay, I looked up who the smallest city of Tennessee is, and it says Oakdale, Tennessee, the smallest town. But also, it's worth noting that there are not just one, but many places that are categorized. I looked this up not that long ago, actually. I don't know why I looked this up or not, but they are categorized as literal ghost towns. These are a real thing. I thought this was died out in the 1800s, but they are literal ghost towns in Tennessee. So there's nobody in them.
Listen, if there is anyone who would defend the IWGP Heavyweight Championship in a ghost town, it's Kota Ibushi.
I agree. Kota, come
on
over here.
Against the ghost of that ghost town.
Well, there are like, isn't there some kind of like Bell Witch story or something for Tennessee? Like that, like some kind of horror story of a ghost that haunt Tennessee. I saw a ghost when I was 3 years old, Striga. I'll have you know. Huh? So that, you know, maybe we have a connection, me and Kota Ibushi. We have a spiritual connection as well.
Let's see. There's a website that that says these 8 haunted places in Tennessee, as in really haunted, are totally creepy.
Oh, okay.
So let's see what we got here. Tennessee Not State Prison in Nashville.
Oh, wow. A prison. Will he defend it there? You couldn't pay me to go to any
Bell,
of these.
Yeah, there it is. Bell Witch Cave in Adams, Tennessee.
See, I would never go to the cave anywhere. Like, any kind of cave.
Kota Ibushi would go to the cave.
I am so afraid of stuff like that. You know, if you put, like, a human person, it could be the biggest badass, a martial artist, whoever. And I'll be pretty brave of them in a physical confrontation. But if it comes to something like that, like hauntings or ghosts or demons, I don't want any part of that. I would run out of there and scream like the biggest coward, pretty much, if you put me in the cave or the prison that is haunted, according to this website. I don't know what these facts are on this website you looked up, but I don't want any part of any ghost. Kota Ibushi, you do that. You deal with the yokais and all that bullcrap. I don't want it. I gotta bow out, so I forfeit the IWGP title match. Your first defense, V1, in the ghost town, in the Nashville State Prison.
Wow. On the topics of ghost towns, Dylan.
Yes.
There was a brief moment in time where people figured that Wrestle Kingdom might take place in front of an empty Tokyo Dome, because the city of Tokyo wanted the Japanese government to declare a state of emergency for Tokyo because the COVID-19 cases have risen to a new height in Tokyo, in the prefecture of Tokyo, and in the surrounding prefectures, I guess, too, because Saitama wanted to declare that stage 2. And it's pretty wild that just around this time of the year, all the companies that for the last couple of months had not announced any attendances, all of a sudden started to announce attendances again. For example, DDT and Tokiyoshi Pro.
What a coincidence.
Yeah. So I have not read the latest about how the state of emergency is going to unfold now in Tokyo. But this did not lead to New Japan running an empty arena. They had a lot of fans in attendance, actually, when you really think about the circumstances that they ran these shows in. 12,689 for Wrestle Kingdom Night 1 and 7,801 for the second night. So there is really no use in deeply analyzing any attendances in the COVID era, but I think there is a comparison that can be made to last year. Because much like last year, the pre-sales for the first night were much, much stronger than for the second night. We can see this because a couple of days before Wrestle Kingdom, New Japan stopped selling tickets, much like the Japanese Football Association did. They sold tickets for the Emperor's Cup, and they stopped that a couple of days after Christmas, I believe, when they first discussed the state of emergency. And now the pre-sales for both nights can be seen here in 12,600 for the first night and 7,800 for the second night. So the strong walk-up, of course, that we had last year couldn't be done this time. And in comparing those numbers, Dylan, the question that came up in my mind was, why, in the first place, why did they put on Tanahashi, Okada, and Naito all on night one, and neither of those three was on night two, when they knew that the walk-up last year, the pre-sales last year were much stronger for the first night than for the second? Shouldn't they have balanced it out a bit better?
Absolutely. I don't think there's any question about that when you look at it. I think Naito was destined to be on night one because he was the champion, obviously. But there's no reason why they couldn't have put Okada and Ospreay onto the second show.
Exactly.
If they wanted, or even Tanahashi, like you mentioned, and Oka, if they want, maybe they just didn't want Oka to have that big of a spot or, this earlier on. But I mean, it's a one spot difference. You know, third from the top or second from the top. So I don't know. That's a great question. I wonder why they front loaded that show. Maybe they saw last year's attendance. If you remember, night one did so much better than night two, and this was more or less them just throwing in the towel. More or less on night two, they put everything on night one to try and get as big of a show as they could in night one, and because it was so much bigger last year, like you said, there was a strong walk up. I think people were, any last second buyers probably would have been hooked by Naito and Okada again, but overall it still did much less than the first night. So I think that might have had something to do with it. Maybe they punted on night two. Considering the pandemic, considering last year, that could be an explanation. I'm not saying it's the right move, but that may be their way of thinking. That's just speculation on my part, of course.
What would have been interesting would have been if they had backloaded the two nights.
Since, I actually think that would have been smarter.
Exactly, because January 4 is the traditional date for the Tokyo Dome. People will go to the Tokyo Dome on January 4. And I think last years have proven that people will come nonetheless, I would say. I would go that far to say that. Of course, there's going to be a difference how strong your main event is. But if they had backloaded the shows, I think that the second night would have had a bigger pre-sale than the first night had.
I think that's very possible. I also think they were hesitant to do that for the reason you alluded to, in that nobody knows what the main event was going to be, so they couldn't advertise it. They could if they did something different, but with the way they did the story of the tournament, it had to be a mystery. So I think that would have been maybe a little bit sketchy on their part to try and backload a show with no main event, you know, on paper until one day before. So that might have been why they didn't do that. But I'm with you. I actually think it would have been better. If they do this again, I hope that they avoid any kind of like back-to-back, you know, title defenses and do something where you can already announce both main events. And then we can see something better.
I do think the lesson that we've learned from these double shots, especially from last year, as I said, analyzing this one is not really a good way to go right now in this circumstances. Yeah. But the lesson that we can take away from last year is when you announce a strong main event, people will buy tickets.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. That's been the history of wrestling for the
Yeah. No real rocket science here.
I will say this. The one thing I'll say about the crowd is, by the end of the night, like, we're going to get into it, obviously, by the end of the main events and everything, but by the end of the night, the second night crowd was still, you know, into the matches, at least I would say. So that is something, even though there were many, many less people on night two than night one.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're not going to run through both shows from top to bottom or from bottom to top or whatever you want to call it. I thought about making a list of things that we go through because there were some comparisons that you can draw on both nights. So let's tackle the shit first, Dylan.
Isn't that what everybody wants to hear first? Yeah. The shit?
Japanese Don King. Dylan.
What
do you think about the theme song?
I mean, a classic. What a performance we saw from Mr. Don Kinashi here.
Yes. Noritake Kinashi is a Japanese comedian, actor, singer, artist, you name it.
He's done it all. I mean, he is a complete legend.
Yes.
And, I mean, he brought us back to remember the days when you had Taguchi dressing up as Doc Brown from Back to the Future.
You know, when I first saw this video, I thought he was Taguchi.
It could have been Taguchi.
I took a closer look and I saw, okay, that's not Taguchi.
They could have had Taguchi impersonating this guy, though. I think might have been even more entertaining.
It would have been better.
Or he could have come out as like a stunt double or something for him. And maybe, like he could have taken a bump and then the real Don Kinashi could come out and set things right. I think that might have been better than what they actually did. But yes, he gave quite a performance, quite a song, and Riki Choshu was there as well. So everything that the fans would want of New Japan Pro Wrestling.
That Riki Choshu appearance was another car crash.
It wasn't
Because
the just.
he had his, I don't know how old was this kid? 2 years old? Three, maybe?
Yeah, like three. Yeah, three. It'd probably
He
be
had
about.
his very young, I suppose, nephew with him, dressed in a suit like Riki Choshu. And this little kid was crying his heart out because apparently, of course, he had no idea what this all was. And I gotta think that Power Hall, the song of Riki Choshu, the entrance theme, it was probably really, really loud. And of course, ears of kids are much more sensitive than ears of grown-ups. And so I think he was really, really frightened and scared of all this, what happened there, the big stage, the lights, the song, the loudness. It was not a good idea.
Yeah, that probably could have been rethought. I think this whole ceremony or whatever at the start probably could have been handled a little bit differently, but definitely a far cry from last year with Liger's retirement to
Oh,
kick off the show.
yes, definitely. Well, on night one, we had the New Japan Rumble. And after the Rumble ended, first of all, this Battle Royal had four winners.
I was so confused. I really had no idea that was what that was all
You
about
didn't know?
until
That's even
no.
better.
No.
This match had four winners, man. I mean, in the end, they did it quite well with all three young lions being still in there, and then Fale, Bushi, Owens, and Toriano walking to the ring while he was still there. And I saw some people on Twitter saying, "Man, they could have done a match with Minoru Suzuki, Tomohiro Ishii, Sho, and who else was there? Henare, for example." But that was never going to happen. That's not what the King of Pro Wrestling actually is. It is just, no, it's just a mere comedy title.
They can bring in Irie for this.
They could.
He's a freelancer. I know you wanted to say him a second ago. Why not?
Why not?
Yeah, he might have been more interesting than who we actually got. But yeah, I get where you're coming from, to be honest. Anybody expecting like, oh, Ishii versus Goto or whatever. Like, this was not the purpose of this whole King of Pro Wrestling thing. So yeah, I mean, like, you have to look at New Japan. You can't compare it like to like all great matches. They're trying to have a variety show, pretty much. So they wanted to have that
Yeah.
little moment for you. And they always try and take care of Yano in his own little role. I don't know if I'm alone on this, but I think it's better to have Yano in his own little world with this King of Pro Wrestling title than to actually have a real match on the show, like for the tag titles or some crap like that.
I totally agree with that. And for whatever his role was on this show, I enjoyed him in his little world, as you called it, because man, it doesn't take away really a big, big spot on the show. Then again, the Toru Yano thing, he has done that for 15 years now, and that is really admirable that he has made a career of a gimmick that has started in like in 2004. I think he started his run when he was DQ'd all the time because he was drinking sake in the ring. I think that's how it started. And he has made a career of being a lovable goofball and of really not taking big bumps or like one or two bumps every now so often. But overall, if you compare him and his body and his way of walking and moving around to Hiroshi Tanahashi, this guy probably is the smart one.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of talk on Twitter all the time when he is in the ring, claiming that this guy is this comedy genius. And man, he's
Don't
not.
that.
He has done the
Yeah.
same shtick for 15 years now. And I do think it is very insulting to claim this guy is a comedy genius when at the same time there are wrestlers running around in Japan like Stocker Ichikawa or Kuishin Bokamen. Those guys, they are comedy geniuses.
I think that I've said this for years now, like that exact same point, and I could not agree more with what you said. Exactly, like, he's not even a good comedy wrestler.
I mean, I wouldn't go as far as that. I think he's good at what he does, but it's not like he's reinventing the wheel.
Well, let's put it this way: what he does is over, so he could do it over and over,
sure.
And that's fine. But for me, like the magic died a decade ago, at least. I'm not even joking. Literally a decade ago, I was over this whole deal, and yeah. But I mean, he's for a worker perspective, yeah, he's worthy of praise. You know, and he's somebody that it's easy to see why people wouldn't like his stuff. So I think people who like him are automatically going to clap back. A little bit similar to how Tai Chi was for a while, where it's like his fans went way up there for him, and you know, Yano is that same category. Like, some people are going to say he's a genius, and I mean, like you said, ultimately he is the smart one, and the fans are into it, so you can't really knock it in the New Japan world. But that doesn't mean it's anything I want to see. Like I said, if it was up to me, we'd have the Ishii match, you know, or whatever. But for New Japan's way of booking, if you look at it from the New Japan perspective, it makes total sense why they would do this. And Yano is very, like you said, very good at what he does in his role, even if I don't really, from an aesthetic perspective or an artistic perspective, I don't love it that much. But I mean, you know, it's fine. It's over, so.
Yeah. You know, the Young Lions had their spot in the New Japan Rumble. They didn't have a spot, though, on the second night, because, of course, they had to do the King of Pro Wrestling 4-way match as the opener of the second night of the Tokyo Dome show. And I have no idea why. Chase Owens, Bad Luck Fale, Bushi, and Toru Yano in the opening match of the Tokyo Dome. Instead, they could have, for example, had Yota Tsuji, Yuya Omura, Henare, Gable Kidd in there, but they chose to do the King of Pro Wrestling thing, and there's no use to get upset about that, but if you're Henare and you're getting your big spot in the New Japan Rumble once again, man, Finlay wasn't even on the show.
Yes, he still did. He leave?
I think he left because he wasn't even on the last run of shows in the Kurokanal last year in December.
We miss you, Finley.
Hopefully,
you're safe. But yeah, you know, those guys, those Young Lions, and all of that. Like I said, ultimately, maybe if it was a longer show, but they purposely kept things a little bit shorter on these two nights that they had, and you know, like I said, they'll have their time eventually. Someone like a Henare, who's been around forever, is even much more troubling, I would say, for his perspective. But at the same time, it's like, what realistically, like, I mean, I know from a wrestler's perspective, you're always going to think that your break's coming right around the corner, and he has had reason to believe in the last year. But in reality, look at your entire career. What do you expect? Like, in all honesty, like, where has he been? Look at the tag league. Like, his team was the lowest rated tag team in terms of points that they scored.
Yeah, of course, Tanahashi.
Yeah, of course they weren't going to have a spot for him. Like, I mean, I know that sounds harsh, but like,
yeah,
you know, like he there's no way you could realistically think he was going to be in the plans. I mean, he got a moment in the Rumble or the Rambo or whatever. But, I mean, can I just say that Rambo match was so lame? Like, you had guys like Goto and Yoshihashi. It's like, they didn't even take their shirt off for this. Like, they just...
Togi Makabe is the king of this.
Yeah, no, well, he never gives effort even in tag matches, let alone the Rambo. But, yeah, like I said, people, like, this was, like, totally no effort. The only spot that was memorable was Suzuki and Nagata fighting and brawling backstage. It was totally worthless of a match.
People always say that this is a match to get everybody on the card, but if only
half
two guys...
Like, they didn't want to be there.
Exactly! If only two guys in a 21-man Rumble even give a shit, why have the match?
Yeah, it's like I said, like the six-man... like, that would have been the match I would have tried to book, would be the six-man titles, because then you could get guys on there if you wanted. But I mean, I also wonder, how did they come up with these four names for the King of Pro Wrestling title? Chase, Fale, and Bushi to face Yano.
Are those clearly the kings of pro wrestling?
The Mount Rushmore of New Japan, right there, clearly. There, it's like, who came up with this? You had a singles entrance for Chase Owens and Bushi in the Tokyo Dome. Who could have imagined if I'd said that last year? next year, you will see a singles entrance for Chase Owens in that dome.
That would have been a great prediction.
That would and yeah, it would have been the craziest one, but it ended up coming true. But yeah, like, there's nothing to really even say about these matches. They were just comedic and goofy, and they served their purpose, I guess. But I mean, if I enjoyed them, of course not. Like, everybody knows that, you know, I thought this sucked pretty much, but you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, that you can say about really a lot on this, on these two shows, specifically also about the two tag title matches. First, of course, the heavyweight tag title on January 4. G.O.D., Tama Tonga Tangaloa, once again are now the IWGP Heavyweight Tag Team Champions for a seventh time. And, well, I thought at first, I was, yesterday morning I had a quick call with work, so I missed a couple of matches in the middle. I saw the tag title, the first half of the tag title match I saw live, and then I went back and watched it again, and I actually, when I watched it the second time, I liked it a bit better. I thought the work that both teams put in there, Taichi Zack Sabre Jr. on one side, the champions, and challengers Tama Tonga and Tangaloa, I thought the work was good. They put a lot of effort into their match. The problem, though, was these are two heel tag teams.
Yeah. I mean, and you even had a heel finish, too, with how things came in, with the Giotto stuff coming in, the Iron Fingers, and all of that. So you had that stuff. And like you said, two heel tag teams, not really good combination. Already, remember, in the Dome and the rules, the crowd's not going to be, you know, you're not getting those mega pops that you used to get in the past. Mm-hmm. So, not that this match would get that anyway, but regardless, it's going to be an uphill battle for these guys to get a reaction. So you're not going to have that, and that's what heel spots are made for—is to ultimately get heat. And in a place where there's no fans, really, or the fan interaction is minimalized, would be more accurate. When you're in that role, it's much harder to do a heel match of any sort. Like we saw the Tai Chi matches at the New Japan Cup. Those really didn't work at all. And now you have a heel versus heel match, and that's even doubly poor, I would say. So, yeah, that was the problem. But I agree with you, actually. I thought the work in the match was pretty solid, all things considered.
And I do think that all four were very motivated going into the match. And G.O.D., they had this new gear, very shiny gear that they put on specifically for this big moment for them. I think it's a big moment for them to finally win the tag team title in the Tokyo Dome and not lose it, because that's what they've done in the last couple of years. They've been champions for a couple of years in Wrestle Kingdom and always lost. Now it's the first time that they actually won the titles there.
Absolutely. I think that they're actually a solid team as a tag team. I just think that in New Japan, that's a big moment for them, but I think the immediate reaction to any fan is like, them again. You know, pretty much, because they're so stale. And, I mean, I'm sorry, but shaving the beard off isn't really going to change that. they're like, I mean, that's cool and all, but he looks way younger without the beard, I will say that. And I can relate to that, because I'm the same way. Like, a super baby face without the beard, but the beard ages you a little bit. But regardless, I think that's just not enough to make them a fresher team, and I think people want new faces in this division. And at the end of the day, I like them. They're like, I actually like them as a team. They work pretty solid against a variety of opponents. I don't like the heel stick with the Bullet Club, but it is what it is. But at the end of the day, the most important thing is that we've seen them so many times. And at the end of the day, what memorable matches have they had where it's like, you can point to that and say, this is why the tag division is great in New Japan. I mean, they had a million matches with Evil and Sonata where any of them, like any kind of noteworthy match.
There's nothing that pops up right in my head, so no.
Or I think many people would agree with you on that one, that they couldn't think of it either. So that's what
I'm
saying.
I would have to look that up.
Exactly. So, like, they really haven't had any memorable moments or matches, and they've been around for years and years and been basically the kings of the division forever. So it would be nice if they did something different. I think they'd be a lot better if they went to another company. Like, their little run in Ring of Honor a couple of years ago was really good, you know, at the end of the day. Yes, like
When they threw the Ring of Honor tag team title against the wall of Madison Square Garden.
Well, that whole show was a disaster for Ring of Honor's part. But that wasn't really a run. It was just like, but anyway, like I said, I think they would just be a lot better off in a fresher company with new faces to go against instead of doing the same stuff over and over in New Japan. Because now, I mean, what is the future of this division? And that's another problem at the end of the day. What does this division really mean at the end of the day?
I do think this division is far better off than the IWGP Junior Heavyweight Tag Team Title division, if you want to call it a division. And that's, again, where I raised the question, why do we still have these tag team titles?
Why do we have, like, how many titles are in New Japan right now?
Oh,
like,
too many.
Yeah, I agree with you. The heavyweight division is definitely better than the junior division. But Wato and Taguchi did get a mix-up theme.
Yeah. Master Wato had a great outfit. First time that I really thought that this guy looked like a star in his walkout robe that he had. It was all sparkly and glittering. Yeah, and then they lost the match.
Big Tokyo Dome debut for the master.
I figured like he came, his first singles match he lost against Yoshinobu Kanemaru, and so I figured when he walked out to this match, that would be the setup for him to now overcome Suzuki-Gun, El Desperado, and Yoshinobu Kanemaru, who are still the champions. So, no, you didn't overcome him.
No, there was no overcoming anything in this match. There was the whiskey spot, the heel spot from Desperado and Kanemaru. Taguchi was there. He had his butt stuff that he did in this match. And yeah, Wato. I mean, I agree with you, actually. He actually looked a lot better here than he has in the past when it comes to his look. I think he's getting that down to mix the blue with not looking like a geek. So he's finding a way to pull that off, so I have to praise him for that. The wrestling and where he's at on the card, very questionable right now. And then that match was a total nothing match.
Yeah.
Like that junior tag match. Like, just nothing special at all. I mean, this team sucks, too. This Wato and Taguchi team, it makes no sense why they're even partners, really.
They have no chemistry.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's got to change. And, I mean, but what else can you do? Like you said, it's a one-team division at the moment without Roppongi. If Yo was still around, we would have saw Sho and Yo in this match to do again, just like they did all the other times that they've had that match. But instead, we had to figure something out, and who's left over? Oh, Wato and Taguchi. Let's put them together.
So, I mean, Taiji Ishimori now lost the junior heavyweight title. I guess he's going back to the tag teams now. They brought in El Fantasmo for this show, too. So, him and Fantasmo, they've been champions before. Another one. And except for that, I mean, Robbie Eagles could come back, but you would have to find someone to team with, I guess.
In chaos. Maybe Rocky.
Maybe Rocky, yeah. But that
Rocky Show could be a team. Rocky 3K.
They could be, but since we're having to dig that deep, that shows you that this title right now really doesn't serve any purpose. It could serve a purpose if the division was stronger, but it's not. And at the same time, there are not a lot of tag teams that are competing for the heavyweight tag team title either. So once again, why do we have the junior and the heavyweight division in the tag team ranks?
We shouldn't. Like, I mean, that's the simple answer. But it's been that way forever, pretty much, like for the last few years. Again, I had this long conversation on Twitter, too, with somebody the other day, where I was saying basically all the criticisms of New Japan were still around in years past. And this is definitely one of them. Yeah. That you could have argued this 3 years ago, that the junior titles aren't worth as much as the heavyweight titles. You know, the only thing we had was Roppongi 3K coming back. And even then, it's like, it was the same deal. It's like they were a one-team division, and they just kind of threw people together around them until something stuck with Desperado and Kanemaru.
Yeah, every once in a while, this throwing around creates a great tag team, like years ago with Kushida and Alex Shelley, for example. Yeah. But for the most part, yes, it's makeshift tag teams like Taguchi and Wato.
Even the heavyweight division has that, like Evil and Sonata, when they were single stars.
Even Ibushi and Tanahashi.
And Bushi and Tanahashi last year. Yeah, another one. It's the same deal. Like, both of the divisions really don't mean anything.
Yeah. That's as much as you can say about the tag team title matches, I think. Diving deep into the matches, I I don't really serves any purpose.
The heavyweight match was better, but the finish was worse, and neither one of them were special at all.
That covers it. So I already mentioned him. The Super J-Cup winner, El Fantasmo, he was brought into Japan to face the winner of the Best of the Super Junior, Hiromu Takahashi, in the opening match of Night 1. And so I sat here, and I, of course, expected El Fantasmo to do his heel shtick, much like he did in the Super J-Cup, where he literally did all the heel moves. And he started out by doing all the heel moves in this match too. And I figured it would lead to Hiromu Takahashi finally overcoming that and the match to become more spectacular, because we know that Fantasmo can be a great wrestler. But every time he does something great, he immediately goes back to the cheating. And you can call it creative. In a way, it is. But to me, it distracts a lot from the actual match. And so we had an almost 18-minute match. And in the end, of course, Hiromu Takahashi overcame El Fantasmo. But for an opening match of a Tokyo Dome show with two junior heavyweights, I think this was a total disappointment.
That's true. You know, you said a lot there, and I will say this. Hiromu Takahashi, the winner of the Best of Super Juniors, El Fantasmo, the winner of the Super J Cup, even though it's kind of a weird, you know, the weirder version, maybe not the same as the classics, but the Super J Cup winner nonetheless. This could have been some kind of dream match, I feel like. Like the Super J Cup winner versus the Best of Super Junior winner, if you had the right people involved. And Hiromu, I think we all love, and everybody loves him. And Fantasmo, I'm sure, like the Bullet Club heel type of fans, they're into him. But to me, this whole deal, like pretty much you just said, my main criticism of him is like he mixes indie spots with over the top heel nonsense.
And he adds Bullet Club moves. The Star Splash is now a transitional move in an opener of a New Japan show.
Even the V trigger, which was a big part of the main event on this very show. It's like the psychology is so weird and not good at all. Like I don't like him. Like I don't know. I don't want to sound mean, but I don't like his wrestling at all or watching him. But you know, it is what it is. I knew what I was getting into. It played out pretty much exactly like we expected. Like I said, I wasn't that mad about it or anything like that. But I agree with you. At the end of the day, if you talk about just on paper, the Best of the Super Junior winner versus the Super J Cup winner, you want to have a classic opening match in the dome. And this wasn't it. This was more of ELP doing his thing. They really put him over strong in the match, I thought, too, to, you know, gain a lot. But to me, I got to say, get him out of here. I don't want it anymore, Striga.
He's going to be around, Dylan. He's going to be champion very soon, I believe.
WWE, come on. Sign my guy, Fantasmo. Give my guy a payday right now. Put him with Jiro. Put him with Jiro in the NXT or wherever they're at. I don't even know what Jiro's doing lately. But listen, if you can't have trade Carlito for El Fantasmo. They didn't want Carlito. Take Fantasmo. Give us Carlito. And I will be a happy camper, Striga. That's what I want to see. Carlito at the Dome 2021. Late prediction. Or 2022. Late prediction. Carlito debuts at NXT. New Japan. Wherever he debuts, he's going to debut. And Fantasmo will get out of here. Yeah. Wherever he is.
You know, New Japan clearly has a lot planned for El Fantasmo. And in the Super J Cup, there were others. For example, if you think about that, ACH could have won the Super J Cup and he could have gone on to face Hiromu Takahashi here in the Tokyo Dome. That would have been much better. But of course, ACH, not a New Japan guy. El Fantasmo is. And so we weren't going to have that. And we had this instead.
I'm surprised they went through the lengths of like putting up that, not ACH, but Leo Rush had the interview on the website where they did this whole thing on him, and then he just goes down in the Super J Cup.
Yeah.
Man, did you know he's on a reality show in America? This MTV Road Rules or whatever? My little sister Cheyenne from Tigercast W on the Patreon, patreon.com/EasternLariat. She told me, she was like, hey, who's this Leo Rush guy? And he's like, he's a wrestler. Do you know him? I was like, yeah, I know him. And she told me he was on the MTV reality show, Road Worlds or Challenge or some bullcrap like that. There's so many real world spinoffs now that I don't even know all of them. But he's on one of them. So he's becoming a reality TV star in America. So New Japan should try and capitalize on that.
I'm shocked that people still watch MTV.
Well, it's Cheyenne. You know, cut her some slack. She's not always there.
Okay, sorry.
Listen, if you listen to the shows, the Tiger Cat shows, you know what my sister's like. But no, she's cool. She's just, she is a fan of MTV. She always has been. She's a fan of Twilight. That's what I got her for Christmas, a Twilight shirt 12 years after its popularity.
Man, and that's great.
She loved it. She loves Twilight. The movies, the books, all of it. But yeah, so anyway, she's a big fan of that, and she recognized him. So I think New Japan should push Leo Rush based on his reality TV stardom that El Phantasmo does not have.
Yes. So I think the two best moments in this match happened by accident. First, El Phantasmo did a flip to the outside, and he landed weirdly on his ankle. Looked like he may have injured him a little bit.
Dang! That was one of the best moments of the match?
And that... And then he stomped on Hiromu Takahashi's hand, which led to Takahashi being worked over in the second match.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
That's why I'm getting there.
I was like, wow, I thought I didn't like him. You're like, yeah, like I popped huge when he hurt himself.
Yes, when he stomped on his hand, I thought it was a great moment. A lot of steam behind Hiromu Takahashi again as a babyface. And of course, it then led to the second junior match in the junior singles match in the Tokyo Dome with Hiromu Takahashi. Clearly, then being the top junior, he, as the best of the Super Junior winner, defeated the Super J Cup winner. And of course, as number one contender, he faced Taiji Ishimori in the semi main event of the second Tokyo Dome show. And I was really happy for those two, Dylan.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a cool little moment for the junior title. Ishimori, he's somebody that's been grinding at this. I mean, obviously Hiromu, everybody loves him, thinks he's a super talent. Ishimori's a guy, though, he's been around for 16, 17 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was starting in, like, really small companies, like Dragon Door and stuff like that. Toriyamon X and El Dorado, your favorite company. Like, he was around during all of that, and he rose all the way up here. You know, him and Ibushi, I've always thought, have had a pretty similar career path, although Ibushi got bigger and was able to become a heavyweight. Ishimori, he's a junior, but they both have a very similar story, where they started out in these really small places and rose up to the top of the, you know, semi-main event and the main event of the Dome.
You can really say that Taiji Ishimori has always been there while I was a wrestling fan of Japanese pro wrestling. He started out in 2002, and the very first wrestling show I saw, the very first Japanese wrestling show I saw, was in 2001. So Taiji Ishimori has always been a name that, of course, I was attached with, because you said he was working for all these companies like Dragon Door, El Dorado, then went to Noah, and of course from there to New Japan Pro Wrestling. And as you said, he always had to claw and fight to find a position in a big, big company. It took him a long time to finally get this big gig in Pro Wrestling Noah to become a main focus of their junior division. And from there, to go to the next bigger place, to New Japan Pro Wrestling. And the story they told now is that Hiromu Takahashi, even though he's not the champion, he is the shining star of the division. And Taiji Ishimori, even though he's the champion, he's an afterthought. And that's the way that Taiji Ishimori approached this match. He wanted to dismantle Hiromu Takahashi. And the way that he worked over the shoulder portion of Takahashi and the arm from the first match that Takahashi had, I thought was great. And it's paved the way for Hiromu Takahashi to make a great comeback and to finally win the match. So this really was a great, great match, I thought.
I thought so too. I think Ishimori is a very talented wrestler, all-around performer too, even though I think a lot of people kind of know him more as a high flyer. If you really look at his wrestling, especially in New Japan, I think he's been somebody that he's shown it. Even in Noah, actually, he had matches with Zack Sabre Jr. where he had a lot of great technical wrestling ability that he doesn't, you know, he didn't always get to show against everybody. And here, again, now you, like you said, he was working over Hiromu, dissecting him, and adding a needed ingredient to this match to counter Hiromu's amazing charisma and high-flying ability that he has, an explosive offense that Hiromu brings. I thought Ishimori was the perfect foil, and they have great chemistry. Obviously not as great as the Best in Super Junior final, which all of their matches will always be compared to, pretty much, but this was better than their matches last year, I thought, that they had at the Jingu Stadium and Best in Super Juniors there. I thought this was an upgrade over those. I thought they did a great job, and a good win for Hiromu as, you know, starting off this new title reign, whatever's going to come of it. It was nice to have this good little moment at the Tokyo Dome here.
Yeah, think about it is, how often can you go to Hiromu Takahashi winning the junior title in the Tokyo Dome?
Every year.
Yeah, every year.
Yeah, like I said, you know, it is what it is. Like I said, I mean, I've said it before that I feel like he has to move up eventually because he's done all he could do in so many ways. And, like, not only done all he could do, done it multiple times at this point. Like, yeah, you said, how many times...
He's, right now.
Yeah, and how many times did he won it at the Dome, even? Semi-main event. The only thing that they could do is if they somehow made the title the main event, but that's very unlikely. Unless maybe that's a big plan they have, like, for and that's going to be their ace card for the next year. And I don't think it is. Like, don't get me wrong, I really don't think it is. But if they wanted to, they could make this the second night main event, the junior title, if they really wanted to go crazy. But we know that that's not going to happen. That's not how they see the division.
Remember last year at this time, we talked about the possibility of a junior heavyweight title main event with guys like him and Will Ospreay.
Yep.
And I think that could have been the match to main event the Tokyo Dome.
Yeah, you had Liger's retirement too. That was something I speculated on. Because I thought that could be a legit draw if they had Liger going for one last time for the title. I thought that would have been a great story. A lot better than a tag match, to be honest, which is what they ended up doing. But regardless, like you know, it didn't happen, and I just don't think they see the division that level. They're not going to bank the Tokyo Dome on the juniors, you know, even if Hiromu is a big star. They need to have somebody to go against him, and they moved everybody else up. I mean, Ishimori is a great wrestler, but they've never pushed him as a main event level talent or anything like that.
No, he's just not what they see as a main event level talent.
Yeah.
There's this big, big, big glass ceiling they have in this company, and few have been able to get past that ceiling.
Yeah, exactly. So that's going to be really tough for something like that to happen. But if he's going to do this title reign, like you said, I think the end game for all of this is Phantasmo, unfortunately for me. But I think that is kind of where this is all leading to. And where Hiromu goes from there, I don't know. But, you know, I do think that both he and Ishimori are very talented guys. It's just, unfortunately, in the juniors, if you're not doing Best of Super Juniors or there's a big junior title match, if you don't have one of those titles, you're kind of on the sidelines pretty much, because like we said earlier, the tag titles don't really mean that much.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, that's where we're at with the juniors. So, next up on my list is the US title and the NEVER Openweight title, two titles that basically mid-card championships in New Japan Pro Wrestling. First of all, the US title. We haven't seen the US title around in months, because clearly John Moxley wasn't available to defend the title while he was the AEW heavyweight champion. So the last time he defended it was in February of last year against Minoru Suzuki. Now, before the match, we had this little video of him showing up in the New Japan USA TV studio where they tape the Strong shows. And he said that he will take on the winner of this US heavyweight title number one contendership match between Kenta and Satoshi Kojima. What did you take away from this video?
What are the odds you think that they already filmed the match with Moxley and Kenta when he was there?
That's a great idea, actually.
I mean, why would he be there otherwise? You would think. Yeah, yeah. See, so that was immediately what I thought. I was like, oh, they must have already shot the match for this when he was there.
I think they've done that. Yeah, that's a great shout.
Yeah, like, I mean, why would he fly all the way across the country just to do a...
Just to do a shit promo?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, come on, Mox. Like I said, we'll fly out here, no problem. We just need you to talk for about 20 seconds to so we can put this little video package before our match.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, what are the odds of him returning to Japan soon?
Very low.
I think so, too.
So I just, there's not even any purpose for it, really. Like to be honest with you, I mean, never mind all the pandemic and the restrictions and all of that. But I mean, realistically, if they could just film it there, then he has no purpose in Japan right now. His home is AEW at the moment.
Wondering what the end game of this title run is going to be. How they get rid of this title will be interesting to see. Maybe Kenta wins it. We don't know.
I think he will. I mean, like you said, what could possibly what could they gain from Moxley holding it and not being able to wrestle for them? Pretty much, it's not like he doesn't even bring it on AEW, so
no,
it's not like you get publicity for it. It's just it's a title held hostage.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah. Well, very unfortunate was that Juice Robinson was out of this match and out of the Tokyo Dome with his broken orbital bone, an injury where I always are very scared when I read it for the wrestler, because I remember that Magnum Tokyo had to end his career because of a similar injury.
It's a very painful injury too. So yes. Hopefully it gets better.
Get well soon there, Juice. So, yeah, in his spot, we saw Satoshi Kojima, and I was very excited for that because, realistically, this one, Kenta and Kojima, in the early 2000s was an absolute dream match because they were in two opposing companies in Pro Wrestling NOAH and All Japan Pro Wrestling. So there was never any real possibility of that match going down during both guys' heydays in either company. So this match happening now was kind of a small little dream match for me. Mm-hmm. But of course, this is not the early 2000s anymore. Both guys have mileage behind them, especially Kojima with 30 years in professional wrestling, Kenta with all his injuries. So I was still looking forward to this match and I was not disappointed. I saw a very well-worked match between those two wrestlers. Match without any real surprises, any real craziness, but just very, very solid professional wrestling in 14 minutes. And I was glad I got to see this match.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a really healthy way of looking at this match, honestly, because you know at this point with Kenta and Kojima a little bit, but I think especially Kenta, has really downgraded from those days, you know, the mid to late 2000s, and you're not going to get that banger match of the year level type of match that you would expect. So if you look at it just as like a little bit of a treat for the old school fans that, you know, followed these guys coming up, like you, and, you know, like me to a lesser extent, obviously not as long as you, but still, I have very fond memories of Prime Kenta and Prime Kojima, Triple Crown Champion Kojima. But just to look at it that way, I think is a really healthy way. I thought this match was solid, not great. Like it really wasn't special as a match. I just think it was more so just to have them wrestle was a good thing. And you know, I liked your explanation of their match. And I the only thing that hurt it for me, I have to say, is that like, and it's not anybody's fault because whoever they were going to put in this role, I think I probably would have felt the same. Like anybody in the Rampo they would have put in, I would have pretty much felt the same. But there was no way Kojima was going to win this match, so it just felt like. Just pretty much what you said. It was a treat for the old school fans. Like, if, you know, a dream match if you have that memory. And I, you know, that's all there was to it. I don't think as a match it really blew any my expectations away or anything like that. It was a solid mid-card match, like a 3-star level match to me is where I would put it.
And if this was it for Satoshi Kojima in a bigger role in the Tokyo Dome, this was a good way to go out.
Yeah, like this is like kind of like his gold watch almost. Not his really his title reign like Nakanishi, but it was still more than they were doing with him before. You know, he would have been in the Rambo if it wasn't for this match. So to give him this call, it must be a nice little vote of confidence for him too to have a little, you know, be picked out to have this match. It's like, hey, we didn't forget about you, Kojima. Like here, you could have this NEVER title or this U.S. title. Qualifier match here, so it was something. Like I said, it's not like it blew me away, but for this show, a good mid-card match, and nothing wrong with it at all.
Absolutely. So the other title in the mid-card, the NEVER Openweight Championship, held by Shingo Takagi. He defended it against Empire's Jeff Cobb in a 21-minute match that is rated at 9.11 as we're talking on Cage Match. And I went into this match, of course, expecting that it would be very good. But it's not like that I was really highly invested into a battle between Takagi and Cobb. But my goodness, what a fantastic battle this ended up being, right?
I mean, absolutely. I 100% agree with you. When they teased this at the end, because I watched every single match of the World Tag League on the Patreon. I know you didn't do that. I know nobody else did it, probably alive, except for
no
me.
No one else.
Yeah, it was just me that did this. But I watched all of them. I watched all the Empire tags. I watched how they set up this match. And when they did that, I was like, man, I had so many ideas. Shingo versus Tanahashi, Hiromu, and guys like that that could challenge Shingo. And it's like, Cobb? So then I wasn't really that hyped going into this match, in all honesty. But here, it's like, for whatever reason, this Tokyo Dome setting, you know, this was a new level. This wasn't even Ring of Honor Cobb.
No.
That's what I would say. Like, Ring of Honor Cobb is a higher level than New Japan Cobb most time, but he turned it up. This was Tokyo Dome Cobb has been achieved here.
I've never seen this guy perform on such a high level ever before.
Yes, absolutely. Like, totally new level for Cobb. And what can you say about Shingo that hasn't already been said? This guy is a master of his craft. He is just an absolute, stunning performer.
He might be, pound for pound, the best professional wrestler on the planet right now.
You can make that case. I think the G1 showed me that you cannot underestimate Ishii. At the end of the day. Like I said, Ishii,
true,
it will be my number one pick if you put a gun to my head. And hopefully you don't do that. There's no need for violence.
No.
I know you won't. Don't worry. It's okay. But that would be my pick if you really put me to the fire or whatever. Shingo would be a great pick, though, as well. And he's a lot fresher than Ishii, as Shingo, he was in Dragon Gate all those years. And it's still only been around a couple of years. He hasn't had the years and years that Ishii has over the last decade. So you see a match like this, and it's like, whoa, boy. you never expected this from Cobb. And Cobb totally stepped up. And what a match it was. I thought this was the best match on either show, honestly.
Yeah, absolutely agreed.
You expected a meat and potatoes kind of match,
Yeah.
Hard-hitting type of stuff. But they put the soul back in soul food.
Yes.
just like the movie. Like, remember, that was the big debate. What was better, Wonder Woman or Soul? This wasn't a Wonder Woman, baby. This was a Soul movie right here. All the way home with these two. Great, great match. And wonderful performance. So proud of Cobb. He stepped up huge in this performance. And Shingo is like, man, this guy deserves everything. That's the thing. It's like they've already kind of slotted Ishii and Goto and these guys.
They're about to slot Shingo Takagi too.
and that's where he's going, unfortunately. But it's like they deserve so much more. Like, I would love New Japan.
Talk about
so much
glass
more.
Ceilings.
Yeah, see, that he's the one that's hit the glass ceiling more than anybody here. It's like, man, if they push these guys as the main eventer and Shingo right now, the fresh face, he could do it all. He could cut great promos, work storylines, work different styles. He can work small guys, big guys. It's like he has a little bit of everything in his game. So
imagine a main event scene being put together by Kota Ibushi, Hiromu Takahashi, and Shingo Takagi.
I mean, that sounds like I'm a New Japan fan.
Dream right now that I'm having.
Yeah, exactly. So that would be amazing, and the potential's there if they all they have to do is pull the trigger. Like, it's not like it's impossible. There's no rule. There's no law. They have not made it illegal to push Shingo, to my knowledge, in Japan.
Maybe it is, dude. Clearly, Jeff Cobb's best match in his career ever, best match of the 2-day stretch, and not only that. Also, want to praise New Japan camera work here, because two moments are especially memorable in this match. The first one was Shingo's tope over the top rope, where they had the camera angle from below, filming the ring from below. And he was, and Cobb was standing there as Shingo Takagi was landing on him. And you felt, as the fan watching on New Japan World, you felt like you were right there in Jeff Cobb's position because Shingo Takagi was raining down on you. That was perfect.
Yeah, that was amazing. There are so many great spots like that. I totally agree. The presentation and the camera work of the shows definitely deserve to be praised. That's something we haven't mentioned, but that was just incredible. And that, like, the razor's edge off the apron tease. Yeah. Yeah, like, that was, I was like, whoa, like, where did this come from? And, like, when that happened, I was like, okay, wait a minute. We've got something here. Because at the start of the match, I was like, okay, Cobb and Shingo, I'm sure it'll be good. You know, I'm not saying, like, Cobb sucks or anything. I'm just saying that it was, you knew, you kind of figured what you were going to get here. It was going to be a good little mid-card match, kind of like Kojima and Kenta. And then suddenly, wait a minute. This match is something different. This is a different guy here. We're seeing something special. And I thought we'd had a, like, this was a Wrestle Kingdom match. Fans, I don't care if there was, it was in a village or wherever. In a ghost town or the Tokyo Dome, this was a special match, I thought. Like, this was Wrestle Kingdom level, for sure.
Then again, Shingo Takagi's facial expressions are so great and so over-the-top great. Because, I mean, a move like the Black Tiger Bomb or the Razor's Edge to the Crucifix Bomb, however you want to call it here, and this move is made or broken by the guy selling it. And if the guy just lies there like a dead piece of meat, the move won't come across well. But when you have someone that has great facial expressions, the move comes off as the most dangerous move of all.
Absolutely. And I mean, the way they set the camera up too was really cool. They had him from the floor as they set that up. But yeah, just a great match. There's nothing I'd say about this. If you haven't watched it, even if you're down on New Japan or whatever, please watch this match. It was really good stuff. I thought it was awesome. And like you said, we both are in agreement. It's a clean sweep, the match of the weekend.
Absolutely. So I do think that Jeff Cobb earned a lot of respect from the New Japan fans, from everybody watching around the world. And that is great for him. He, of course, lost the match. And this brings me to the question, Dylan, was this the third piece that led to the Empire already crumbling?
I set that up with the tease of the clean sweep earlier because I knew we were going to go to the Empire losing all their matches. So I just want to point that out right now. I want to praise myself. Never one to sell myself short, Striga, right here. But the Empire crumbling. I thought that they were going to lose just how New Japan books. They're really hesitant sometimes to really push things right away. And to me, a logical version would be that you would put the new group over strong.
Yeah.
But historically, New Japan hasn't really done that. Even with LIJ, they had Evil lose right away to Goto and all of that stuff. They could have done it. You know, they could have gone a different way. But, you know, I think because of how they built the storylines, they were kind of forced into this. It's like you weren't going to have Okada lose when the whole story has been about him finally hitting the Rainmaker. Cobb, it's like, were you really going to go there? I mean, you could have had Cobb win. You know, you could have had Oka win even, or Okan, if you wanted. But it's just not how they played it. And I think it made sense, to be honest. After the first two losses, I think it made sense for Cobb to lose. It would have just been kind of weird if he had won. It's like the third guy in the group is the one that's the strongest one. Okay. Like, so that I understand why they did it. I didn't really have a problem. And like we said, Cobb ultimately got super put over even in defeat. And I think really that was the goal of all of this. Like, all three of their matches had similar goals, to put them over in defeat.
Yes, I'm sure about that. And of course, this question that I raised was completely overdramatic and not true. The Empire will not crumble. They are a new group that New Japan is getting behind.
It's all very much over. It says time to break it up. Send Ospreay back to England. Send everybody away.
But yes, but still though, the question is, why is New Japan booking their shows in a way that oftentimes they book themselves into a corner where they have matches that neither guy should lose? That happens a lot.
Yes, that is another question entirely. You think, like, if I were in charge of booking this new group and they said, look, we want to get this new group over, I would have them beat people that they could beat, and it wouldn't hurt them.
Mm.
You know, like, okay, so for me, they wanted Ospreay in a big match.
Yeah.
So that's another thing. It's like, you have to fill different goals here. So you have to make a little bit of sacrifices. You want him in a big match. You want Okada in a big match. You want Tanahashi in a big match. So it's like, you kind of have to fit the pieces in place. Because historically, or whatever, if I were up to me, I would have them win the six-man titles and go on a long run undefeated. You would have had a great match with the Chaos team, who have like proven to be great workers, obviously. They would have got a big moment. They could have made the titles mean a little bit more with their run, and you would have had them not taking falls. But I mean, it's clear that they don't care about that. Okan's first match was a loss to Okada in a crappy match. The tag league was totally, you know, they didn't really make very much noise there. So it's clear that they don't care about jobbing these guys out very much right now.
No, for
whatever reason.
I still think that what you said is right. They still position them as threats. And even though that Great Okan has now lost to Tanahashi too, he still will be a threat. And in that role, he has... Well, you can say he has completely taken over Bad Luck Fale's role, in a way. Of course, not being that big of an obstacle like him, but still, the role is very clear. He is Ospreay's bouncer, in a way that Bad Luck Fale was the bouncer to Prince David back in the days. And yeah, they put him in this big role. And what did you think about the Tanahashi and Okan match?
I thought it was okay. You know, like I really didn't think much of it in terms of it being terrible, nor was it special. I think this gimmick is going to get over.
Yes.
With Great Okan. I don't personally like it, but I think that it's going to get over with the fans, and I can see him being like a cult favorite. I don't really see him being like main event level yet, or anything like that, or any kind of future star, really. I mean, I think they're going to give him every chance at the end of the day, similar to Jay White, who started his career off with a big match versus Tanahashi the Dome as well, when he came back from Excursion. I think they're going to give Okan every chance to get over. Will it be successful? The jury's out, but I do think that this gimmick will get over. And even if it's just on a grassroots level, we had already seen in the past where you had guys in the crowd like dressing up as him, as his entrance attire and stuff like that. I think that he's going to get over. He does a lot of unique stuff too. I don't necessarily like all of it, but I do think that it's nice that he does a lot of unique things in the ring, and how he's really invested and bought into this character as well, which you can see. This is not the Olympic wrestler Oka. This is a completely different style of character.
So I chose to watch both shows with the English commentary of Kevin Kelly, Chris Charlton, and Rocky Romero at times when he was there. And they talked about his Olympic background, and they talked about him not being a pro wrestling fan growing up and being scouted by New Japan and running through their Olympic wrestling team that they have. And they kind of talked about how this led to him being a different kind of wrestler. And I think that's a nice explanation for the gimmick, why he moves so differently than any other wrestler New Japan does. And this match with Tanahashi, as you said, it was an okay match, but it was not designed to be a great Tokyo Dome match. It was designed for Okan to find his role and to get comfortable in big roles like this in the Tokyo Dome. And in this match, he was guided by Hiroshi Tanahashi, one of the biggest stars, if not the biggest star that the company has had in years and years and years. And I wouldn't say that he passed with flying colors, but I would say that he did a good job in this match. And he's slowly finding his role. He's slowly checking out what is working with the crowd. For example, I think that the Mongolian chops, he does them in a weird way, but I still think that this Mongolian chop is a thing that he should use more often, and that will get a good reaction eventually. And he's going to be fine, I think.
Well, I don't like that explanation about this character is not any kind of Olympic deal, or him not being a fan. Like this is the most pro wrestling character that you could have.
The character is yes.
yeah, like and even the way he wrestles, like, is totally like crazy and over the top. Like I have to say, I do think his entrance too. That's another thing worth pointing out. He has a really he has an interesting presence about him when he comes out, like just crazy manic type of person here with his attire. He pops off the screen at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. He does have something. I see something there with him, but is he going to be one of my favorites? Right now, the returns are not that promising, but I do see him getting over in the New Japan world. Even though, like, to me, I would much rather see a pure type of wrestler or whatever. I think that there's a place for this guy on the roster and a place for this gimmick even to do something a little bit different. But, I don't know. I thought it was an okay match. Oh, one thing I wanted to mention, too, I noted down here. I really liked Tanahashi in this match, too, guiding it. And the biggest spot of the match to me was where they did the tease of him grabbing the chair. And, I thought that was a nice little wrinkle to his character. Like, the former unbeatable ace, the record-setting champion in the past, is he going to stoop so low to, mm-hmm. like, he can't win on his own now? He needs help because he's older and broken down. He has to use the chair. But, I mean, he didn't do it, but I thought that was a great little, you know, cerebral tease from the ace himself here. And another reason why Tanahashi was awesome. I really appreciated that, adding that spot into the match. And it put over Oka, you know, in a weird way, because it's like, this guy's a little too much for me. Am I going to need this? It made him show doubt. Even though he didn't win, he forced Tanahashi to flinch. So I think that is a little bit of a moral victory if you wanted to aim it that way. And I think it's an interesting deal for Tanahashi going forward for whatever they have planned for him this year. They could do that. They could go a lot of different ways with that storyline if they keep it up.
Yeah, that's a great shout, definitely. I like that too. So the second match with the Empire on the first night was Ospreay and Okada. After the match, I was really kind of stunned because on Twitter, I saw a lot of people throwing out 5 stars. I saw that, for example, W.H. Park, he gave it 4.75. On Cage Match, we have right now a rating of 9.18, so better than the Cobb and Shingo one that we called the best match of either show. What did you think about this one?
All I have to say is, who predicted that the crowd would pop when he finally hit the Rainmaker?
You did.
That's right. And we saw it here, even with the rules. The rules did not stop this crowd when the Rainmaker came at the end of it. The match itself, though.
To the match, why did Ospreay do the Rainmaker first?
I thought that, I would have loved it if that was the finish of the
yes!
match.
Yes!
that would have been perfect. Like, that would have been such a brilliant...
Not a year for Okada to do the Rainmaker.
Oh, that would have pissed everybody off so much. Yes. Dude, that I couldn't help but love it if that had happened. But from a story perspective, none of this makes any sense. Like, at the end of the day, that's my main problem with this whole deal. It's like, at the end of the day, what was the point of all of this? And the sad part is, okay, so what they're going to try and tell you is that the story was perfect. His grudge was so strong that it finally made him break out this Rainmaker that he swore off for no reason in the summer. He finally brought it back. The problem is, how did they start this match, Striga? Was it a grudge? Was there fire? Was there an attack? Or was it a lockup? And they went to the ropes.
It was a slowly worked match. And that is, it's a point that I'm going to steal from a good friend, Jesper. He made the point when we discussed the shows in our group chat. He said that Will Ospreay's idea of heel work is just work slower. And that's the thing that he did in this match. He worked slower. And whenever he felt like it, he turned it up to do high spots. And, I mean, he did some great high spots. For example, this Falcon Arrow deal through the table, that was great, I thought.
Oh, yeah.
Then there is another...
At one point? The big snap powerbomb he hit?
Yes, absolutely. Great stuff they did throughout the match. And I don't want to sound like I didn't like the match. I thought it was a great match. But I don't think that it was any kind near of a perfect match, like many people called it. Because there were clear issues. And the one issue is Ospreay's heel work. He has not found a way to balance his clear ambition to be a spectacular wrestler with the new heel character. He has still a way to go to balance it out. And the second issue that I can't ever unsee now is, especially in these venues that are not filled with a lot of fans, is usually a big, big strength of Japanese wrestling. Because Japanese wrestling is based on strikes that sound like it hurts. And they place the strikes, whether it's kicks or forearms or whatever. Wrestlers are trained to place those strikes on places, on so-called safe places on the body. But they usually connect. But none of Will Ospreay's strikes connect. He always slaps his thigh, and you hear it. When he wrestles a guy like Okada, Okada uses his strikes, and they make a sound, and Will Ospreay's, they sound like a clap. And that is, to me, a clear issue that I couldn't overlook. But still, though, I thought that the story that they told in the end with Okada overcoming Will Ospreay and then finally hitting the Rainmaker was so emotional that it got a lot of people, including me, invested into the match and the story that was told.
Yeah, I've always felt that way about Ospreay. Personally, he's never really been my style of wrestler. For me, you know, that's a big reason why. And it's a good point you made that, you know, like you said, in Japanese wrestling, one of the biggest strengths is having that realistic sound, the, you know, the feeling of a fight going on, fighting spirit. That's a very big thing. And Ospreay, like you said, he's still working this indie style of strikes with the thigh slaps and all that. And it's pretty lame when you counterbalance, even against Okada. Okada's not somebody I would consider a heavy hitter in the Japanese wrestling world by any means. But compared to Ospreay, he was definitely a lot better. I agree with you. But there were many spectacular moments in this match that you would want to look for. Like you said, it was a slowly worked match. I just think that the story of the match was lost with how they ended up working it. Maybe they were trying to serve too many masters at once, like you said, trying to get over Ospreay's heel work, but also serving this emotional Okada story. I think it would have been better if they had worked it like a grudge match instead of what they ended up doing here. And, you know, they had the big spots and everything, but I never felt that heat until the very end where it was, again, it was all about the Rainmaker. And if you really even take a second to think about the story is so stupid that I'm sorry, I could not get into it the way you and the others did. Because it's like, we even in this match, we saw him use the money clip a bunch of times. And why? Like, what is the explanation? If you know that the Rainmaker is this kill shot, what inspired him to, A, get rid of this Rainmaker in the first place, and B, bring it back against Ospreay? Because the match leading up to it had not really been that much more heated, than any of his G1 matches. So why did he bring it back, other than, well, it's the Dome, and now it's his time to bring it back? It felt very robotic, in my opinion, and not natural, and not earned. Actually, like, just with the storyline, if they were going to do this, they needed to really ramp up that intensity. And I don't think that was here. I think we had a spectacular wrestling match, but I don't think it fit the story.
Good part. Good part there, definitely.
But I liked it, too. I do want to say that I liked the match, too. Yeah, but I think that that's a flaw in it.
And I think the reason for it is that Okada and Okada only, in my opinion.
Yes. Yes.
Because he approached this match from a way that it really had to be for him. This guy turned on him. And in a lot of ways in this match, in a lot of moments of this match, you could really see how pissed he was at Ospreay. And how pissed he was that Ospreay is still standing up to him. Ospreay, though, as you said, he has this approach to wrestling where he's still going the indie route.
And the acting is sub indie level. whenever he has to show emotion or facial expressions or try to act, Ospreay is just not getting it done for me, man.
Neither is B Priestley, actually.
Oh, B, yeah, B is just
greatest moment before the match, by the way, was when B was waiting for the kiss and Will wouldn't turn around and she was just sad and going off the apron.
I didn't even notice that.
That's amazing.
I think I might have already been checked out on his entrance. But yes, great point on your part. I love that. What, man, Ospreay is such a geek, man. I'm telling you. Like, I'm glad that he works a heel character because he really is, like, super unlikable. Mm. But
the
still,
Commonwealth I would give Kingpin.
What does that even mean?
I have no idea.
Like, that's such a stupid... I think he's better as a heel than a babyface, because there's no way I could get behind this guy. Even when he did the stuff before, it was like, oh, I represent Japan, I have my sword, and I can cosplay too. Like, that stuff came across super lame to me. Like, that was not a babyface gimmick at all, in my opinion. So now, at least, that he gets a proper response as an unlikable heel. But I still, like, if they make him act, I think he comes across really, like, super not a main event talent at all when it comes to that. But the wrestling was good in this match. I have to give them props for that, even though I think there were problems with the story and the acting and all that. If you just look at it as a match, though, I might not be as high on it as those guys, like the 9 out of 10 and all that. But it was a good match and a worthy, you know, match on the Wrestle Kingdom shows. Maybe not the second best match on the shows, but still, I think it was a Wrestle Kingdom worthy match. And you got the big... At the end of the day, as stupid as it all was, it got its desired goal across, which was to get the pop for the Rainmaker. And it, yes, and it worked at the end of the day. So,
is Will Ospreay telling us that he is more important than Queen Elizabeth II? Because right now, she is the head of the Commonwealth.
Well, he said that he didn't say he was the king. He's
not the kingpin. Yeah.
Yeah. So that means he's like a drug dealer to the Commonwealth. I think that's what he's trying to say.
Oh, amazing.
He's providing the coke right now to the Commonwealth.
All right. So let's go to Sanada and Evil.
Oh, great.
What the fuck was this?
I think the Kingpin provided Gato with drugs before booking this match. I think was the only explanation I could give.
You say that there were flaws in the Okada and Ospreay match.
I think.
Where do I start here?
I thought this was a brilliant match, Striga. I don't know what flaws you're talking about. I thought it was unbelievably executed. Perfect storytelling. Just execution like you would never see, especially from Sanada. I mean, it was pinpoint accuracy. Bret the Hitman Hart would have shed a tear at this match, I think. Just a wonderful performance. Surely a 10 out of 10 overall rating. The first in cage matches history, I would say. What is the rating for this match? Please let us know.
6.55.
Oh, well, that's not what I would have rated it.
I think that's fair, I think. The match itself, if you look at the match itself, it was not bad. If you just look at the match.
Okay. There's no other things involved.
There's no other things. It's just the match.
Okay. It wasn't that bad. You see this on paper and you expect, I expected a disaster, to be honest. But it wasn't that bad. If you just look at the wrestling.
I also expected complete, utter nonsense. That's what I expected. Well, kind of. So, this was a grudge match between the two. And going back to the G1 shows that we did, I said that in the G1, you had never had the feeling that these two were former tag team partners who have become mortal enemies now. At least, from Zanada's point, in some ways, I thought that he brought some more life to it here than he did in the G1. But Rocky Romero on English commentary, before the match, he predicted a bloodbath. He predicted this would be something completely different from any other match that we've seen on this show. And I'm sorry, it was not.
It was not that, yes.
They started out and they did their spots. 10 minutes in, I was wondering, how long was this match? Let me see. It was 23 minutes. Yeah, about 10 minutes into the match, I was wondering if this would get any more dramatic if they had run through all their spots. They really did all their usual spots that they always do. And, well, then they brought some life out of one another, but in the end, it was more of the same. Evil. He has the same box of tricks ever since he turned heel. And you would expect that in a big situation like this, there would be something new that they would think about that Evil could do. But no, they do the same stuff all over again. It's Dick Togo, the table, the cable, choking Zanada, the chair, all of that. And the worst part of it is that this same shtick has led to him lose the G1 match to Zanada. And it's the same shtick that now has led to him lose to Zanada again. So, in my opinion, this character is completely done. What else can you expect from him?
I completely agree with everything you said. I don't think there's any way you can argue that. I mean, this all sucks, you know, and it's not even logical. Like you said, it's not really helping him. And I don't know what purpose it serves, because if you notice, there was one point in this match that totally defined this whole run, this feud, this match, this rivalry, whatever. It was when the historic and the memeable spot of either shows of Dick Togo going through the table.
Greatest
what was ever. What was the reaction from the crowd to that?
They laughed.
They laughed. This bloodbath grudge feud was filled with a laughter. And one of the biggest spots of the... like that. That
to be quite honest, that was a great, great spot. I loved it.
Well, I mean, it was aesthetically, yes, it was very funny. Like, I mean, I'm not denying
that. He made
that.
Sure to do a diving elbow drop through the table.
He did. Like, when I saw that on Twitter, I was like, what? And I watched this live, and I saw him go through the table, and it was like, I didn't pay that much attention to it. But then I saw it on Twitter over and over and over. And I was like, why did he give an elbow drop through the table for? I thought
really
that exact
same table.
It was the real feud was between Dick Togo and the table. Yes. That was the bloodbath. But like I said, it was so out of place for this. These people are two of their most pushed commodities. This is not like two random guys. You know, this isn't Master Wato in here. This is two guys who have been either double champions, one of the only double champions, or a guy who's gotten a million title shots in the last 2 years at G1 pushes. So you have two of the top people in your biggest faction, this whole feud that they build in, and that's what you get. You get laughter and dumb crap because of they're so obsessed with this Dick Togo stuff. And, you know, good for him for getting a paycheck. Yes, I agree with that. But what a waste of all of this. And I just thought, like, for a grudge feud, like, it's one of your biggest Tokyo Dome singles matches. That, I mean, that reaction says it all. At the end of the day, I can't make my point any more than that.
Zanada, as a babyface, is either too stupid or too stubborn to learn from his mistakes. And even that, as I said, you'd expect some new tricks from a heel like Evil in a big match like this. And you also would expect the babyface to finally learn something from his mistakes. And in the biggest match of the feud, he would not make the mistakes again, but he did. He had the skull end in, let the skull end go, did the moonsault to the back, and then Evil got his knees up. The exact same spot that they've done before.
Yeah. I mean, these guys are both idiots. When you put it that way.
But then again, I'm gonna cut Zanada some slack. Because the story is that he went into this match. He didn't want to have a bloodbath with Evil. He wanted to stay true to himself. And however you want to rate it, he did stay true to himself. And that won him the match.
I love it. I love that explanation.
Isn't it true, though?
It is true. Okay, like, and look where it's taking him. He's getting a title shot next. So really, who's the real winner here?
And it's so crazy that even though Zanada is this idiot, he beat Evil.
I don't know. I think some people may have jumped the gun about Evil being the solidified main eventer and all of this. He's going to be one of the faces of the company.
Maybe someone did. Maybe.
I don't know. I don't know about that. I'm having serious doubts about that right now. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, this match just didn't really work for me.
I mean, it's very clear now that Evil is the placeholder for Jay White.
That's pretty much exactly how it turned out. You know, with everything, I think we're already at that point. Where it's
we're proven. At that point, yeah.
Yeah. See, so yeah, I mean, this match didn't work for me, but I mean, if you're into the LIJ story, I'm sure you could get behind this. The
fans are behind that, yes.
Yeah, the fans were pretty behind it. So I can't really rip it too bad, even if I thought it was dumb. It's like, at the end of the day, it's over, so.
But it's just not what I expect when I expect a big grudge match. I don't expect the dudes to do the same spots over and over again and see basically the same match. The one thing they did in this match that brought you back to that tag team was when Evil went for the Magic Killer with the ref, but the ref shrugged him off, and Zanada did the neckbreaker from the ropes. That was the one moment in the match where you actually figured, okay, that these guys do have history.
Yeah, I mean, that's
but
true.
It's a very small detail.
Yeah. I don't think this is a good match at all, personally, but it is working. Evil had that merch numbers that came out. They were sold out for his merchandise or whatever, so good for him. But for me, I agree with you. Like, I honestly, I didn't like this match. So I don't know how many ways I can say it. It's just that it did get over. So I have to give them some kind of praise for whatever led to it. But for an aesthetically pleasing match, I just don't think this really fit the bill for me at all. And I agree with all of your points you made, actually. I think you were completely on the money.
Yeah, absolutely. So before we go to the heavyweight title matches on both shows, of course, I want to shout out that Stardom had two offer matches once again on the second night of Wrestle Kingdom. First one was Tomi Hayashishita, Asumi, and Saya Kamitani defeating Maika, Himeka, and Natsupoi. Great moment for Kamitani getting a victory, a pinfall in the Tokyo Dome with the Phoenix Splash over Natsupoi. And the second one was Julia and Shuri defeating Mayu Iwatani and Tam Nakano when Julia used the Glorious Drive on Nakano. Great image also here in the match when Shuri and Julia did the same spot that Julia and Hana Kimura did last year when they did the big boot spot on, I think, Tam Nakano they did it.
Yeah, it's a really poetic and beautiful spot there.
Absolutely.
Somebody's got to teach that kid Saya not to steal moves in the main event in the dark match.
Love it.
Yeah, somebody's going to be a grizzled vet on here. But no, that's a very cool thing. All of them deserve it. You know, they're all good workers. So, good little moment there to be in the dark match. Maybe one day they can work out the TV deals and all of that. It'd be really cool if we could see these matches.
Yeah.
But, other than that, that was nice. Good moment for them.
Totally. So, Kota Ibushi.
Before we move on, there's one thing I want to say before we get to that. It's something I didn't even talk about before the show, but I would like to mention it here. What do you think of this new TV deal that they have teased for New Japan? Because there was a video package on this with Naito.
Yes, that's true.
And all of that. So yeah, they're teasing a new TV deal in the US and the UK.
I don't think that has come out yet where it is, right? In which station it is.
No, it just it's like coming soon. pretty much.
Yeah, and that can mean anything, you know. That can mean that they run at 2 a.m. in the night on a niche channel. Yeah. Or they could also have a big deal in the U.S. that puts them on a bigger network, like, for example, ESPN or something. I really can't rate it right now because we don't know anything about it.
Yeah, that's not gonna happen. ESPN.
I'm just throwing out names.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, don't worry. He's not American, people. So he doesn't know the networks that well. But yeah, so like, it would probably be more like an Access level deal, even if so you would expect that. I do think it was kind of a bummer. We never really talked about it that much that they lost their TV. It's not that important to us because we watched the show live. Mm. But there was a group of fans that, you know, they watch them on Access. You know, like they follow them on there in America. Some people aren't that, you know, they're not going to watch shows on their computer or are trying to hook things up to their TV to watch Japanese wrestling. They just want to watch wrestling on TV. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of a big deal. I think that kind of led to a lot of the stuff that happened with Harold going in there. I think that was kind of a big blunder. I mean, I get not wanting to work with TNA and all, but still, you have to be a little more logical. So it's good to see them back on TV. I think that's a good deal for them. Maybe we can see New Japan strong, and they can boost that American product, like American style of product that they have, if they have an outlet for it. So I think that is worth mentioning, even though, like you said, it's too early to call, really. I do think it's worth mentioning, though.
I really think that all the strong stuff that they did is a holding pattern for just that.
Yeah.
Well, an eventual TV deal they have. And I don't know, man, if they get a show on television, it would be probably a good idea to mix Japanese footage with their American footage. to get the guys over that they have there in the US, and then also from time to time show a big match from Japan to get fans invested in that product as well.
I absolutely agree. I think that would be the perfect way to go about it. And like you said, the strong run is almost like a trial run for any kind of US TV deal they could have. A lot of people speculated that with the purple involved, could that mean something? I don't know. I don't want to read into it too much, but we'll see where it goes. I just thought that was worth mentioning because they did tease it. They also had the new phone game they had with Naito advertisement. Are you going to play it?
Actually, no. Actually, funny advertisement with Kidani on there. He's a great actor.
Kidani's very amusing. I agree with you. Have you ever played the phone game?
No.
Like the card game that they have on the phone?
No.
I'll trade you for a Goto, Striga, if you ever play it.
I get a free Goto. Sounds great.
Okay. Let's get to the main events.
First night, Kota Ibushi came in as the one that lost both matches last year. And this time, he won both. First, he defeated Tetsuya Naito in 31 minutes to win the double championship. A match that has 188 votes on Cage Match, 8.77. What did you think about the match?
I thought it was a great moment for Ibushi to finally win the titles. You had the dramatic ending where you had Naito strapping the titles on Ibushi. I thought that was really good. And I think the character beats were all there, like to make this all work at the end of the day. But again, I do think there were some flaws in this match, not to sound overly analytical. In particular, I think it's the same problem I had with Naito and Okada last year in that, okay, we've done this whole deal, and when it came time for the end of the match, all the stuff that happened to his leg and any kind of selling that had to be done by Naito was basically thrown out the window. Mm. At the end of the day, it's just like, let's just get to this big run. And it worked at the end of the day, so it's hard to really argue. But aesthetically, again, just my own personal opinion, I think that could have all been done a little bit better by Naito. But everything else about it, the story beats and the action was really strong. They did all the crazy bumps that everybody...
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that was the entire story of the match, is that they want to do this style of wrestling. That's their approach to wrestling. Basing a match around dropping each other on their heads.
But at the end of the day, that's just a spot fest. Like that's my problem with their other matches. Like everybody always is mad about the head drops or whatever. I don't care. Mm-hmm. Like I don't care if they want to go out there and do anything.
I'm not going to be there sitting here once again and criticizing them for that. I've gone on to accept that they are going to do that, but as you said, it's spots.
Yeah, like it doesn't. I never liked their wrestling matches because of that reason. I think they had one big one in the G1, and even then, it was kind of like they had the big pile driver off the middle rope and stuff. They kind of just moved on from that. But I thought that was a really good match, and every subsequent iteration has been more and more of a spot fest to me. And I think that's kind of how this was. I don't think this was their best match. I think even people that like these guys and will like all their matches, I think even they would tell you that this probably wasn't their best effort here in the Dome. But for what they wanted and what they went for, like you said, this is their style of wrestling.
Yeah,
they accomplished what they wanted to do here. They took every bump in the book. And they had a dramatic win with a big finishing stretch and an emotional moment at the end. So they got everything they wanted to across in this match,
except for all the drops on the neck and whatever. One spot that I remembered is the double foot stomp that Kota Ibushi did, where he kind of really landed in the middle of Tetsuya Naito's stomach, and I gotta think that hurts a lot.
Yeah, you know. I asked somebody about this one time, about the double stomp from the top, because this is just what somebody told me. It's just one person's opinion. I don't know if it's the same for everybody. But I was like, man, how do you work that? That move looks like it hurts like hell. Yeah. And basically, just to break the rules a little bit, their idea was you have to like hit it and then pop off right away. Like, don't stick it. But like you said, here he stuck it. So it looked like it hurt. Yeah.
Oh, man, that looked terrible. Even amongst all the other stuff that they did in the match. The match itself, as you said, it was highly spectacular, and that's what they wanted to do. That's what they accomplished. And then, though, the finish, in my opinion, was very poetic, because it was Kota Ibushi doing the V-trigger to Tetsuya Naito, and then going to the Kamigoye to finish Tetsuya Naito off. And I thought that was a great moment.
Yeah, I thought, you know, I thought it was. It plays into his storyline. Obviously, that set everybody, any kind of AEW or Kenny Omega fan, set them on fire pretty much with this V-trigger into the Kamigoye. But it was a great moment, I think, if you just look at his own character, pretty much to finally win the title. You know, I thought it was a big win for him, obviously, an emotional moment. I was really on the edge because, to me, I think the logical storytelling is exactly what happened of Ibushi winning both matches. But I thought that Naito was going to win, to be honest. When I went in there, I always go with the stars when I look at New Japan booking. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I mean, this is where we're at.
But now, it's really very abundantly clear that Kota Ibushi has gone on to heights that no other wrestler in Japanese wrestling history really has accomplished. Because look at this guy. We talked about Taiji Ishimori before. And much like Ishimori, Kota Ibushi has started in a then very small company with DDT. And he is not a New Japan Trueborn, not from the roster, not from the dojo. And as someone not being from the dojo, it is usually very hard to go above some glass ceilings that we've called out before. For example, Shingo Takagi, he has clear glass ceilings, but Kota Ibushi seemingly doesn't. He has won everything in New Japan Pro Wrestling. The only titles that he has not held yet is the US Heavyweight title and the Never Open Weight 6-Man Tag title. And of course, if you want to call the King of Pro Wrestling title a title, that one too. The only tournaments he has not won is the Tag League and what else is there? He has won everything else, right? I think he has won every tournament else.
Has he won the Junior Tag League?
No, that not. But except for that, he's basically won everything in New Japan Pro Wrestling. And this is really something that has no roots in tradition in Japanese pro wrestling. A guy coming from a small indie company and going on to be the major star of one of the two biggest companies in the day, New Japan and All Japan. That would have never happened in the 80s or even in the 90s. But it has happened now in 2021. And I was really afraid when he won the match that this would be a one-day run because I didn't want to rule out Jay White standing tall in the end. But in the end, it was not a one-day run. It seems like it will be a longer run. And I really can't stress enough how unprecedented all of this is.
Absolutely. In the history of Japanese wrestling, like you said, this would be pretty much like if Hayabusa had won the Triple Crown.
Yes.
You know, but before perfect. Yeah. And that would be unthinkable. Like, you know, obviously before his injury. Like that would just simply wouldn't have happened at his time period. But now here, that's you know, that says so much about Ibushi, his talent, his popularity, everything he did, and the journey he's been on throughout the years to get to this point. You know, he started off as a junior heavyweight even in New Japan, so this is kind of like a shining light moment that hey, this could happen to somebody out there, a small skinny guy right now that has no name, where, you know, like Ibushi when he started. I mean, he was always a prospect, you know, even from the beginning. It's not like he just came out and, you know, and nobody liked him for 10 years and he suddenly popped up. And he was scrubbing it for 10 years. It's like he was a prospect right away. He had that big match in 2007 in Noah with that big run, you know, with the tag team with Mara Fuji. And to make it all the way to here, though, it's still such, like you said, very unprecedented moment in Japanese wrestling history and specifically New Japan history to see this happen. And it shows to show his growth as a performer, as a wrestler, and as a star in this company to finally achieve this and get the biggest win of the entire year in wrestling and the biggest win of his career at two back to back, like you said, going in there. But before we talk about the Jay match, because I think that's all, you know, that like you said, there was a lot of will they or won't they? Will they really screw over and kill Ibushi dead in the middle of the ring? Just shoot him in the head, Gato, if he did that. Will they do it to put over Jay White, more or less their chosen one that they've decided to push here? Will they do it? There was a lot of expectation on that. What do you think about Naito now? Where does he go from here? because I think that was actually the more interesting part of night one, because we didn't know what was going to happen on night two, was Naito losing. Again, another example of what I always say, they never go with their biggest star for whatever reason, and again, he loses it with no real title defense or a very small, short, brief title run here, and I think, where does he go from here? Because you can't... His story is over, like, to me, in New Japan. When it comes to winning the titles, he's accomplished what he needed to. He's main evented the Dome a bunch of times. It feels like, this was his last hurrah, almost, as a top tier star. Not to say he won't be a main eventer. He might even get the titles again.
Sure.
But to me, like a Tokyo Dome main event level guy, this felt like the end of the line.
Yeah, his story was told last year in the Tokyo Dome when he won the double title. That was the culminating moment of his wrestling career. It can't get any bigger than this.
Yep.
So losing this title, I read takes on Twitter yesterday that said that he kind of looked relieved. And I can see that, because I do think that a big weight was lifted from his shoulders of being the champion and carrying this company on his back, literally on his back. And now he gave the titles to someone else, and he gave him, literally, he gave them the two belts.
This was literally a passing of the torch moment.
It really was. It really, really was. And for Naito, I do think that he will become what Tanahashi is now. He will be the stepping stone for the up-and-coming talent. He will have matches with guys like Uemura when they return from excursion. He will be the gatekeeper in the Tokyo Dome for those to make the next step.
And it's no secret that he's had a lot of injuries over the years. He has had some spectacular performances in this match, and also, not even that, look at the Tanahashi match in the G1. That was one of the best matches of the year last year. So you know when the time comes, he can turn it up, and the fans are going to buy into him so much, it didn't even matter. Like, whatever flaws you want to poke into his game or whatever, the fans are going to be with him no matter what. But it just feels like a really big drop ball, again, that he never got that big title reign at his peak. And now it feels like his peak has passed him by. Like you said, he passed it to Ibushi in a figurative passing of the torch. It was not a literal torch. It was title belts. But still, I think that it feels like that it's passed him by without a real Okada-esque title reign, more or less, or an ace-setting title reign that we've seen historically in wrestling. I felt his popularity warranted it, but for whatever reason, they decided against it. So I think that's an interesting call that they've made. And it feels, like you said, now it's time for him to step into that Tanahashi role. And it's just a kind of a crazy thing to see. Like, these main eventers of the past, the guys we know and have always seen in the top of the cards in New Japan, to see them literally before our eyes take that step back and, go downhill. Same thing that happened with Nagata and Kojima, but even more pronounced to see guys like Tanahashi and Naito do it.
Absolutely. But man, I guess it's time for Tetsuya Naito to eventually move out of the way. But of course, as you said, he will probably, maybe he will be champion again. But the biggest moment clearly has been there last year. But now it was time for Kota Ibushi to make his first title defense against Jay White. I want to stress this again. Jay White won the briefcase from Kota Ibushi and got the shot at the title. And Kota Ibushi got the shot too, just because the champion said so. That's the story that was told.
Those are the rules, Stricker.
Yeah, that are the rules. And, Kota Ibushi versus Jay White ended up being one of the longest matches in Tokyo Dome history. I'm not sure how many others are there that were longer than this one.
I think it might be the longest.
It might be the longest, too, yes. 48 minutes. It went. It has a rating of 8.98 on Cage Match. And I want to say this. Ibushi's story in this match was to overcome the odds. That was the entire story of the match, and that was the story for the 48 minutes of the match. He had to overcome the odds and ghetto. And for the first 10 minutes, I really liked the approach that Jay White had, was to ground Kota Ibushi with everything that he had. And I once again want to stress that I really like the way that Jay White does that. The work that he does is, in that sense, very good. But then they had this idea to stretch this out over 48 minutes. And at the 20-minute mark, I was wondering, for how much longer can you work this one point that you have? And they did work it for 20, 25 minutes before Kota Ibushi then eventually had his comeback and returned to the match. And for the first 20 minutes, he really only had some brief moments where he hit a strike or broke free from Jay White, but he was always on top of Ibushi. So that was the story. And then Kota Ibushi slowly but surely worked his way back to the match, and he had Jay White backed into a corner. And they had this moment in the match where Red Shoes Uno was literally pleading with Jay White not to fight against Demon Ibushi. I thought that was a great moment. Yeah, and then this all led to Ibushi hitting the first Kamigoye and Jay kicking out, really in the last split second. Great, great near fall, by the way. And Kota Ibushi did the Phoenix Splash. And they once again had a great camera shot, great camera angle for this, so that you didn't see Gedo. And you thought it would be it. And to be quite honest, the Phoenix Splash finish would have been perfect for this match. What do you think?
I totally agree with you. I thought that would be the total, and especially because the other finish was him using the V-trigger.
Yeah, they this went back to it.
Yeah, it would have been so much better if he had won with the Phoenix Splash. It's like, yes, I did this. This is a remnant of my past I won with, but now I'm in the future as me, the move that I right. have always used. You know, like that, well, that. I thought that would be so much better. I totally agree with you.
So I think they completely ruined the perfect and logical finish for this match. And for what? For Gedo having another moment in the ring.
That's, I mean, like,
yeah.
Yeah. Like, I mean, what can you say? Like, you couldn't say it any better than that. This was totally Gedo to jerk himself off, pretty much.
Exactly. And then this match, of course, had to go on another 10 to 15 minutes to then, prepare the eventual finish. But then again, they did this great callback to the match where Jay White won the briefcase. And I gotta say, once again, this near fall, oh, it wasn't even a near fall because, yeah, it was a near fall. Red Shoes Uno counted, but he saw Jay White's feet on the ropes this time around. Where in the first match, in the briefcase match, this was the finish, of course. So that was a great near fall. And then there was another great near fall from the Blade Runner, where Kota Ibushi really only popped his shoulder up. And you couldn't really see it because the camera was in front of both guys. So that was another great moment in the match. And then, once again, yeah, he did the V-trigger and the Kamigoye, but it was kind of told in reverse. The V-trigger should have been done before the Phoenix Splash, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think the match should have ended on the Phoenix Splash. Or even if he had hit his own, like the Phoenix Plex, I would have gone with that too. Yeah, just as long as it was one of his moves and not the Golden Lover's moves, I think it would have been a much better story to win with the V-trigger on the first night into the Kamigoye and then to do a different move on this one. I think would have been a lot better aesthetically as well as just for the story they told. I think it would make Ibushi, it would show his growth in a two-match span pretty much that they did here. But instead, they kind of went with the idea of, well, he beat, I mean, again, another reference to the Golden Lovers because he beat Omega's record for the longest match with Omega and Okada with the 46 minutes, 46-45 they had. And now these guys went 48 minutes and 5 seconds. So I thought that was a nice little touch there to do that. Whether it helped the match itself or not is another story, I would argue, because like you said, I think they had the perfect finish. And like you said, the Gato stuff totally was just very irritating, as always. But there was, like, do we really need to have Gato pull the referee out at that point? And especially that deep into the match. It's like, man, I wish they could have just avoided all of that and just had a normal main event. Because I thought they had there's a lot of things to love about this match. If you just dissect it apart and look at both men's performances. You mentioned some of the near falls. I noted that as well. Both men did a great job of having really weak kickouts, but in a good way. Like, you know, like to where it made it seem like that, especially for Ibushi, who this man at the end of the day, had to be an Iron Man in these two shows, working back-to-back matches, and Jay gets the heel tactic of having to rest on the first day and having being fresh on the second. So I thought that was a great little moment to show Ibushi and really put him over strong as well. And, you know, there's a lot to like about the match, but unfortunately the cheating and all of that, that's never going to appeal to me, and I don't think it was needed. It's not just that it appeals to me, It's that I don't think this was the right thing to do for this match.
What's the reason for having a heel manager? The heel manager, in the end, is there to provide a cathartic moment where the babyface eventually gets his hands on the heel manager. Of course, that happens in basically every match. They punch Ghetto in the face, but he pops up right away. And there is never really anything that lasts. Ghetto is always back and always does the same. So there is no reason for this to go on because there is no end game to it.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, we had the Kamigoye in this match as the big spot where, you know, that took him out or whatever, but it was just totally unnecessary. And like you said, there next time, next go around in the next Big J match, we're going to see the same crap over and over pretty much. I also didn't like how, just me personally, if you remember, so all that happens with Gato and it leads to Jay hitting the Blade Runner. And that was the quote-unquote first big kick out, even though, like you said, it was a terrible camera angle they used. Their biggest blown spot of the weekend by far, and what was otherwise a really good moment.
There was one other in the junior tag title match where the camera zoomed out and Master Wato was doing a running dropkick to start off the match. Very few missed camera spots in this on this 2 days, but this one was a big one.
Yeah, this was a big one. This was a screw-up, the very first ever kick out of the Blade Runner. But so I didn't like how they did all that stuff. And what did it lead to? The submission for Jay White, the Ibushi tap out, the Tanahashi tap out, whatever it's you want to call it, the reverse figure four. I thought that there was no way that Ibushi was going to tap out. And I think that they would have been better off just cutting that out. But at the end of the day, it's hard to say they need to cut something out because you have to understand their goal in this match was to beat the other record, to make it the longest match.
And they... Once again, like the Ibushi versus Naito match, they had a clear goal. They accomplished that. Here, they had a clear goal, and they accomplished that too.
And exactly. So everything they did, they accomplished. Even if it was just kind of lame to put Gato over in that one spot, they accomplished it. So you have to give them praise for that, I think. But as a match, I do think it was a long in the tooth. I don't think that Jay is the right person to carry these kind of matches. Although I was impressed, like you said, I was really impressed by their actual wrestling and a lot of the things they did here. I thought they put on really great performances. The sum of its parts were better than the whole, if I were to make an analogy.
I do think that is a great assessment of the match altogether.
Yeah, and even at the end, like till the very end, where you had Jay clinging on to the title, like the last moment you see before Ibushi gets the title is like Jay trying to grab the titles.
You know why they shouldn't have cut out the submission spot is that Jay White was completely in disbelief that Kota Ibushi had kicked out of the Blade Runner, so he had to go to another one. He had to go to a move that had won him something before, and he was nearly crying while he held Ibushi in the reverse figure four because Ibushi was crawling to the ropes and Jay White was in complete agony about that. So that's why they couldn't cut that out.
Excellent point. Now that you say that, I completely agree. Like, you totally turned my mind around on that spot. Like, now that you say that, yes, that absolutely makes sense. And now that I'm thinking about it, he did sell that really well.
Yes.
I thought Jay, I got to give it up to him. You know, nobody's his biggest critic more than me. But I really thought Jay had a great performance in this match. This is one of his best I've ever seen. Even compared, like, I know everyone loved that G1 match, but I thought here he was even at another level. And in general, I think he's really gotten his character to a T. Like, I thought for a long time people really overrated him, but I think right now, like, that character work he's doing is really strong, and I have to get, you know, I'll give the devil his due on this one. You know, even he honestly, in real life, he seems like a nice guy. I don't want to rip on him, but, like, you know, I've always hated on his wrestling, and I haven't been a fan of his, but I thought he did a spectacular job in this match, even though, like you said, some of the stuff they did and the overall package of it was a little lesser for the reasons we stated, but I think you have to give both of these men great credit. And Ibushi, yeah. Back-to-back nights, too. Two back-to-back main events here, and I think he really gave it, you know, put his heart into both of them, even if there were flaws and maybe not everybody loved them. You have to give the props, yeah.
I mean, Kota Ibushi is a guy that says that his day has 25 hours. Of course there's going to be a flaw.
Yeah, I guess so. And does that mean Jay has 23 hours in a day?
Maybe he steals one from Jay.
he stole it from Jay here. Just like Red Shoe stole the titles from Jay when he was clinging on him at the end. I thought that was a really great spot where Jay was like, no, take the titles. I mean, it wasn't that animated. It was actually, he acted it perfectly. To contrast what we talked about with Ospreay earlier and some of these other goofy facial expression guys, I thought Jay really hit the nail on the head. The perfect mix, what you want to have in a wrestling actor.
I think we talked myself into liking this match more than I thought I did. I'm probably not as high as the cage match users, but I
was there
8.98, as I said.
Oh yeah, okay. No, I'm not that high at all.
That's a little high, but still, though, as we pointed out, very good work by both guys.
I thought it was a worthy end to the shows.
Yes.
At the end of the day, you know, I thought it was.
Jay's role as Switchblade is probably forever going to be the antagonist to the babyface champion. But eventually, he has to turn face eventually.
Whether he's a star or not to Japanese fans still remains in doubt, to be honest with me. I mean, this was a great performance, but it is, you know, at the end of the day, it is worth saying they put this all on his character for day two. They pretty much punted, and the results weren't great. I mean, there were a lot of reasons behind it, but it's like, it's a whole history now. It's not just this show. Show me the evidence where he is a huge star to the fans at the end of the day. I think that's a lot of people maybe liking his work, which is totally fair. But I think that we've yet to see him really emerge as a true, a star at that level of a Naito, Okada, and now Kota Ibushi level, or I would put him up there. I mean, that remains to be seen too as well, but I mean, history has shown us that's likely true. I'd like to see what they do with White. Like you said, maybe he'll turn babyface eventually. Because, you know, like you said, you've always said this, Strick, especially you and everybody that is a big fan of Jay. There's a great worker in there. And we all saw it when he was a young lion. We know that there's a great babyface worker in there when he turns. But instead, he's doing the storytelling thing with Switchblade. And I haven't really loved it. And I still don't love a lot of it, to be honest with you. But I do praise his work and his efforts and his abilities as this character, which has really surpassed what I felt about him for a long time. I don't really see him as a tip-top tier main eventer right now. But I think that he can get there. And that's the first time, like, after this match, this is the first time that I really have felt that with him, because I've always been really underwhelmed by him in general. But I think he's really showing and proving me, and proving a lot of his fans right.
Yeah.
So I agree with you, yeah.
Yeah, I can totally see what you're saying there. And we, of course, taped this before we knew what happened on New Year Dash, but surely we are going to talk about New Year Dash. We're going to do another show on the weekend, where we talk about New Year Dash and some other big matches that took place in early January in Japan. So we can talk about the future then. But what is your final word on these two shows?
Yeah, one more thing. After the match, Sanada came out.
Right.
Yeah, with his suit that he had, I thought he looked very nice. Mm-hmm. In the suit, and that's going to be the next title challenge for Ibushi. This is kind of like the first title challenge with Jay White, but this is his next title challenge with Sanada. So, what do you think of Sanada as the choice here to face Ibushi?
Man, makes perfect sense. The two were in the G1 final. Let's do it again.
Yeah, absolutely. He won against the Evil.
Yep.
You know, Sanada basically made it seem like that would be a number one contenders match, and the promo was ahead of it. It made perfect sense. We'll see where it goes there. Sonata's another guy that he could be a guy that they're going to really get behind. Like, when is his time coming?
And also, I want to shout out that they threw a great wrench into people believing that Kota Ibushi would win, because when Sanada beat Evil, people were figuring that the heel would win the main event. And so, great little detail of booking there by New Japan.
Yeah, I think so too. I think overall this was about as best as I could have hoped for from a booking standpoint across both of the shows. Like, Ibushi winning was exactly the logical play in my book, and what I wanted from my personal opinion as well. So I think they did a great job with the heavyweight belt. The junior title, going back to Hiromu, I still have doubts about the importance of it, but they had a great match. Let me say this. I thought night two was a lot better than night one overall. I loved the Hiromu match and this main event as well. I thought it was a very worthy match. I didn't love it, but I thought it was a really worthy match. And you had Shingo and Cobb, which I freaking loved.
Yes, I would say so too. Even though the second night had less star power, the matches themselves were better.
Yeah, it didn't have as many fans, but I thought the matches were a lot better.
Yeah,
when it came to that, so they did. You do have that. You know, you didn't have necessarily the star power or whatever, but you had the work rate on the second night. So I thought they both shows had something for everybody. If you're really into the Empire story, you had Ospreay and Okada. And Okada, one of the biggest stories of the whole year for New Japan. On night one, you had Naito, like you said, the star power. Okan facing Tanahashi. So each show had something different. I thought that the second show was really good, though, and I really enjoyed it, actually. And the first show was okay. You know, I think you would have a hard time not getting into the main event by the end. And I even liked the semi-main event, too, even though we were kind of critical of it. I still liked it. But that was a solid show. It was okay. I was thinking, maybe there's not that much to talk about. But night two, I thought, really popped it off, and I really liked it.
I basically agree with you, because I didn't think about that there was a lot of talk to talk about either, but the second show really was a good blow-off for Wrestle Kingdom this year. I don't think that they will go back to one show, and honest, if they did one show, this would have been too many matches for one show.
Yeah.
I think it's all right that they are doing two shows. You just can't expect those shows to be as great of one show could be like the shows were before they did two nights.
Yeah, I agree with you. I know, you know, it's a business standpoint, a business strategy, so you can't really hate on it too much. And like I said, I thought the second show totally delivered for what everything I wanted. They didn't need any more matches, in my opinion. I thought they had everything you wanted on the second night. And the only thing I didn't like was the Sonata and Evil. And the junior title stuff was pretty lame with the King of Pro Wrestling and the junior tag. But the big matches, I thought, all hit. And even the Sonata Evil was over. So I really have no complaints about night two. And hopefully we can get another night just as good as that next year.
Yeah. And I think those are great closing words for our look back at Wrestle Kingdom. And as I stated, we will do another show over the weekend. So for now, this has been it from the Eastern Lariat. Thank you all for listening, and goodbye.
Sayonara.
Streaming worldwide, this is the MLWRadio.com network.